And so the next case on our docket is United States of America v. Harold Van Hooser. So the parties are ready to proceed. Please. So if you could come forward. One of the questions that we have, no, you can come forward to the podium. Sorry. One of the questions we have is, looks like United States versus Alan Lawrence Shelby is the next case, and they have similar issues. I don't know if you want to combine those. It looks like both of the same lawyers are arguing those two cases. Do you all have a preference, or have you all discussed this?
I don't have a preference. I think that the issues are distinct but overlapping. And so if we did address them in one argument, it would be, I think, helpful to separate out those areas where they're different. I'm prepared to address them in separate consecutive arguments and just refer back to the extent that the same arguments are relevant.
That's fine. That's what we'll do. Thank you.
Thank you.
So here is United States versus Harold Van Hooser.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Bailey on behalf of the appellant, Harold Van Hooser. This habeas corpus case involves challenges to the defendant's sentences under the Armed Career Criminal Act and the 3559C three strikes law. And the most straightforward path to relief that I'd urge this court to adopt is through the ACCA, based on the two clear errors in the district court judgment. First, the district court erred in concluding that the sentencing record in this federal case precluded the possibility of reliance on the residual clause. And second, the district court erred in applying the modified categorical approach to the conviction record of the prior state robbery offenses and determining that those offenses necessarily involved violence.
Well, there's also a burglary. Is burglary offense in Van Hooser?
There are burglary offenses
Those are there too, right?
There are two burglary offenses. That issue was raised under Stitt in the appeal because Stitt was decided.
Right. So you really have, if we get, as we proceed to the merits, you really have to demonstrate that the district court erred in treating the prior robberies as violent offenses and treating the prior burglaries as qualifiers under the three strikes clause, right?
And because there's binding circuit precedent on the burglary issue, the question then becomes, does Stitt overrule?
No, I agree.
Yes.
But you
so
left
we'll
out the burglaries.
Both the robbery and the burglary.
So let me ask a preliminary question. Is the analysis of the robbery convictions, the first degree robbery convictions, the same under the ACCA and 3559? In other words, if they categorically do not qualify under the ACCA, does it necessarily follow that they don't qualify under 3559?
The answer is yes, but it didn't used to be yes, and I'd like to explain.
That's okay.
So both 3559C and the Armed Career Criminal Act have essentially identical force clause provisions. So if the robbery offense is not a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act's force clause, then it's also not a
right.
violent felony.
Right. No, I'm with you there.
Okay, and then also
under the elements clause.
Sure, there's an enumerated offenses clause in 3559C, and it specifically enumerates robbery as defined in certain federal statutes, the 2111 robbery on federal lands, 2113 bank robbery, etc. And so before Stoeckling, I think there was a difference between the level of force necessary for the force clause and the level of force that could potentially satisfy 2111, 2113, and 2118. But Stoeckling held that it's a lower level of force.
So do you think those three federal statutes, which are incorporated into the enumerated clause, really now are generic burglary, robbery?
I think they're still federal robbery, but they do meet the Stoeckling test, which is what this court held in Fultz, relying on Gutierrez, the carjacking case, and Watson, the 924C bank robbery case they held.
And so if they meet the Stoeckling test, they're generic.
Right, and so
robbery.
To that extent, it's the same. But Oregon robbery does not meet.
Right, and I want you to be able to get to that, but I wanted to figure out which parts of your argument that cover it. So why is
I think if we lose on the force clause post-Stoeckling, we would also likely lose on the enumerated offense. Although there are, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. if we win under the force clause of the ACCA, we win under the enumerated offense clause because that's a determination that the force is lower. If we lose on the ACCA force clause, we could still win on the enumerated offenses clause. Although here,
it's the joys of the categorical approach.
There's other requirements of 2111, 2113, like that the property be taken from the person or presence of another that aren't consistent with Oregon robbery. But for this case, it would be determinative.
So in your view, Cisneros is still good law after Stiff?
Yes, your argument. And as I was preparing this case for oral argument, I wonder if remand to the district court to consider burglary might be appropriate because there's also other thorny issues, like, for example, the Valdivia Flores aiding and abetting issue if we reach burglary.
Well, but you haven't raised that.
We hadn't raised that because it was never presented
before. Right, because the district court court thought it was enough that he had the robbery.
Sure, and we raised the aiding and abetting in our reply brief. We limited it to the robbery because that's what had been discussed, and we limited our response.
Yeah, and I'm having difficulty thinking that the aiding and abetting argument is in front of us since it shows up for the first time in your reply brief. But I take it your point is that if we were to get to burglary and didn't rule for you on some other basis, we ought to remand it for the district court to consider that argument.
Yeah, and the primary position would be that Cisneros is not overruled. If it is, then perhaps that would be an appropriate basis for a remand for the district court to consider in the first instance whether these burglaries, which those records are not in front of the court, whether these burglaries constitute generic burglaries.
So you think the rationale we used in Cisneros still survives after? If you could answer it.
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
So in Oregon, building is defined to include buildings or structures other than those adapted or customarily used for overnight lodging. And that full scope of the definition of building was in front of the court in Cisneros, and it was deemed to be overbroad in respect to generic burglary.
Well, it's really movable buildings or structures that are not adapted, right? Because I think that if one burglarizes an office building, that's generic burglary after Stokely, right?
Yes.
So your argument is really limited to non-permanent structures, not adapted.
Yes, that's correct. And those are covered in Oregon's blatant definition of building, which includes vehicles, cars, boats, airplanes. And so there's a number of different kinds of not just movable but mobile structures that are not ordinarily designed or adapted for overnight accommodation.
So is your view that Stoeckling held that those were not within the generic definition of burglary or just didn't treat that issue? No, Stoeckling plainly holds that the generic definition of robbery, I'm sorry, of burglary.
Are we talking about burglary?
Burglary, I'm sorry.
Yes.
The generic definition of burglary extends to non-permanent structures adapted for overnight accommodation. Does it answer the question about whether non-permanent structures not adapted for overnight accommodation are in it, or does it just not treat that question?
It does not treat that question, and it leaves this court's precedent.
Which therefore leaves our previous decision in place.
And I think that's what Muti said. It said it Stitt overrules Grizel to that extent. It overrules the aspect of Grizel that could encompass those mobile structures designed for or customarily used for overnight accommodation, but not any other element of overbreadth as to either the building definition or other definitions like the entering or remaining unlawfully, which was litigated in Cisneros, but not the basis for the ruling.
Can we go back to robbery? I know you may have answered this in your exchange with Judge Hurwitz, but let me maybe ask it a little bit differently just to break it down for me. Does your argument about robbery three rise and fall on State versus Johnson, or do you think that's enough after Stoeckling?
I think State versus Johnson is the case that we've been able to identify that involves nonviolent force post Stoeckling.
And that's the basis of Strickland.
Yes.
And
also the panel decision, the unpublished panel decision in Lawrence Ankeny that said Strickland survives Stoeckling.
So is that enough after Stoeckling? Because it doesn't seem like the Supreme Court was trying to say that if a state uses the common law definition of robbery, that it's going to qualify as an ACC predicate. But I just wanted to get your views on that.
Well, Backing up a little bit, Stoeckling reaffirmed the Johnson 1 finding that physical force within the Armed Career Criminal Act means violent physical force. They carved out for robbery-specific exceptions this rule that physical force that overcomes a victim's resistance is violent physical force. So the question then is, does Oregon robbery categorically only encompass that degree of force? And State versus Johnson proves that it doesn't.
Well, but more for our purposes, because State versus Johnson is a state Supreme Court decision. Strickland holds that it doesn't.
Correct.
And we have to follow Strickland unless it's been implicitly overruled.
Correct. Yes, and because of the narrow holding of Stoeckling, it hasn't been. Stoeckling said, we're modifying what it means to have violent physical force, but again, only in this respect, regarding overcoming victim resistance. And in Strickland, they recognize that Oregon doesn't require overcoming victim resistance because it can be accomplished by nonviolent contact that prevents victim resistance because it's so swift, for example, in the purse snatching in that case.
You want to reserve your 15
seconds. I'll reserve
seconds.
My 15 seconds.
Yes.
Thank you.
And plus 10 minutes since the issues are the same.
May it please the Court. Suzanne Miles for the United States. So I am prepared to jump into the Armed Career Criminal Act robbery discussion, but before we get there, I do want to take a step back and just primarily address defendants' 3559 life sentences. So any direct claim against his three strike act sentences is untimely at this point.
Well, I don't understand that. It may be wrong, but I'm not sure it's untimely. What he's saying is, look, there's been a big change in the law, Johnson. He says Johnson makes clear the residual clause of 3559 is unconstitutional. That makes my challenge timely. What's wrong with that?
So there's two answers to that. First, this court's decision in Blackstone talks about the timeliness of Johnson claims against non-ACCA statutes. And what it says is we simply have to wait. So, in other words,
it's okay. He's going to be in jail for a long time, no matter what happens here. But he has to wait until some court finds that the residual clause in 3559, which so far as I can tell, and you don't argue differently, is materially indistinguishable from the residual clause in the ACCA, is unconstitutional for the same reasons the Supreme Court held the ACCA clause unconstitutional.
So not some court, Your Honor, the Supreme Court.
So 22. Why would the Supreme Court? Well, but
why would the Supreme Court?
How is it ever going to get there unless one of us says it's unconstitutional?
The same way that it got there in DiMaia, looking at 16B, the same way it got there in Beckles, looking at the advisory guidelines, the same way it's getting there this term in Davis, looking at 924C.
Except it's not going to get there because no court after Johnson, which is some years ago, ever is going to impose a sentence based on that residual clause, which on its face appears to be unconstitutional. So unless there's a case on direct appeal where some court was dumb enough to use the residual clause, nobody ever sentenced under it will ever be able to raise the issue under your theory.
And it's not my theory, Your Honor. It's this court's theory in Blackstone. And it's directly from the statutory language of 2255F3. It's Congress's requirement that you may not raise an untimely, this time a 20-year late, habeas petition unless you have the Supreme Court declare a new rule. And the court...
But the question is whether the new rule in Johnson, which deals with a clause which for my purposes I can't distinguish at all from the clause in this case, extends to this. It's a different thing to say whether it extends to the sentencing guidelines. But your position is that this defendant must wait until the Supreme Court declares this specific clause unconstitutional.
Yes.
And if it never does, even though it's patently unconstitutional and he couldn't have known that until Johnson was decided, he's out of luck?
That's exactly what Blackstone says. Now, the mandate of Blackstone...
Let's just say we disagree with you, because we're spending some valuable time on that issue. I don't know if you want to get into some of the others that we might be looking at.
Yes, I do. But I do also want to still address the timeliness issue, because it's not just Blackstone that's the bar here. The second bar is Geozos, which says that in order to raise a Johnson claim, so even if we can argue that the residual clause, that Johnson's rule extends to 3559, you have to say that defendant's sentence arose out of the residual clause, and the district court here said it didn't.
Well, yeah, I know the district court said it didn't, but we review that de novo, do we not?
You do.
So I've gone back and read the sentencing record in this case. Point to me where the district court where the original sentences say they arise out of something other than the residual clause.
So the original sentences do not say it. So what Geozos tells us is that we can either have a direct statement by the sentencing court, or you can look at the underlying legal environment at the time, which is what the judge here did
But then my problem was that the underlying legal environment at the time allowed didn't require a district judge or to go through this difficult categorical and silly categorical approach that we have to go through. The district judge could just say, hey, I don't care if these categorically match. They're so close under the residual clause. I'll use that.
Well, Your Honor,
why should we assume, doesn't the record have to exclude the possibility of reliance on the residual clause, not just suggest that it was possible that it wasn't relied on?
Two answers. First, this sentence was issued in 1997, so Taylor was already on the books. The categorical approach was already
And the government was arguing like crazy. I was around in 1997, and the government was saying, Taylor's nice, but that doesn't affect the ACCA or the 3559 stuff. So, and most district judges I knew took the position you now take about Blackstone. I'm not going to find this is unconstitutional until the Supreme Court tells me it was. So that doesn't help me.
And even if you take that position, you still need to look at the specific holdings in Geozos, which tells us that we do not need to have a specific statement.
No, I agree.
You don't have to.
I agree. If the legal environment at the time suggested it, but now I'm back to your first thing. What about the legal environment at the time suggested that this judge couldn't possibly have relied on the residual clause in these sentences?
Because robberies were and continue to be enumerated offenses under 3559. And so even again, if you want to put aside the timeliness issue and just get to the harmlessness issue, we still have a categorical match here between Oregon robbery and the enumerated offense robbery. We see that from this court's decision in Molinar, looking at a similarly worded Arizona statute, which looked at Arizona robbery and compared it to the enumerated offenses under the United States guidelines and found that to be a categorical match.
This is an argument that I take it that only goes to the 3559.
Only to the 3559.
Okay, so
exactly.
So walk backwards.
We can leave that aside.
Yeah, walk backwards and go to the ACCA
That's
stuff.
Fine. So once we leave those 3559 sentences aside and get to the ACCA, we do have some issues here, too, before we ever get to robbery. So first, we do have a timeliness issue with regard to the ACCA sentence as well, again, because the district court made the finding that the sentencing court did not rely on the residual clause, but instead relied on the
same force
clause.
The district court's finding is a legal one. We go back and look at that record, and I'm stuck with the same – I suppose you have the same answer, but I'm stuck with the same problem here. When I go back to the district court original sentencing, I can't tell what was relied on.
And again, we have another piece of that factual puzzle here, because what we have is that this exact same district court judge was overturned by this court, directed by this court that robbery is force clause eligible just a few years before Mr. Van Hooser was sentenced. And what the district court judge
this is a very creative argument. I really liked it. We slapped the district judge once, so he must have the second time done what we told him he did wrong the first time, rather than rely on the easy out, which is the residual clause, on which he never could have been reversed by us.
And that's exactly what the district court...
That's your reasoning, right?
That's what the district court, in looking back at this record, said.
I know, but we don't give any deference to what the district court did. So forget what the district court said. You want us to conclude that, don't you?
Based on this record, and I think what the district court did is persuasive here, looking and saying that without a doubt...
Your argument today is rising and falling on the timeliness?
No, it's not at all. So we can put timeliness aside, and still, even if we have a timely habeas petition here and we get to harmlessness, that's where we work into the other basis for why these ACCA sentences can
be affirmed. You spent over 8 minutes of your argument, though, on everything, but that you want to talk about that last part.
And I can, Your Honor. And the robbery issue does overlap with Shelby, and Shelby is in a different procedural posture, so we can talk more deeply about the robbery issue then. Van Hooser has a lot of hurdles before we ever get to robbery.
Right, let's assume, for purposes of your next minute and a half or your next 10 minutes after that, both of these defendants leap over all the hurdles, and we get to the merits.
Yes.
Tell us what your
position is. So, again, Van Hooser is different than Shelby because of the burglary convictions.
Right,
and
right.
So,
yeah, so deal with Van Hooser.
Absolutely. And so Stitt, clearly what this court held in Mutti is that Stitt overruled this court's decision in Greisel, taking away the mobile structure problems with Oregon robbery.
But does generic robbery, burglary, the mobile structure, does generic burglary include non-permanent structures not accommodated for overnight use? Certainly, the Supreme Court didn't address that issue. You agree?
The Supreme Court did not directly address the issue in Stitt.
Right. So why doesn't that make the Oregon statute categorically broader than the generic crime?
Because the Supreme Court's decision in Taylor cleans up some of what Stitt didn't address and talks about how the generic definition of burglary that Congress imposed was meant to track the version that had been used by the majority of the states.
Right, but I've looked at other states, and I can't find that other states have the definition that Oregon has, which expressly says this extends to non-permanent structures not set up for overnight use. So the argument here seems to be that Oregon doesn't have the definition of the majority of states. I'm not sure how Taylor helps me with that.
And if I can put that aside, unless, Your Honor, may I have the time to answer that?
She's in charge.
I'll give you 1 minute to answer that.
So, Your Honor, I think that the mobility aspect, whether it's accommodation for overnight use or accommodation for business, is answered by Stitt, that the mobility isn't the problem. The question is whether it's a structure that's accommodated for the kinds of uses that generic burglary is meant to address. And with that, I will leave the burglary issue aside and address the robbery issues in my next argument.
That's how you'd like to proceed. That's fine.
Thank you.
I'll give you 1 minute and 1 minute and 15 seconds for your response here.
Well, I think the court's questions have narrowed the issues because I am not going to plan to spend any time then on the timeliness issues or the pretty blatant Mathis error that occurred in the specific modified categorical.
Can you speak in front of me?
Sorry, she's so tall. Specific modified categorical approach analysis.
But I would like you to address the timeliness issue on 3559.
Sure.
I ask you to assume that for purposes of your response that I don't accept, just for purposes of discussion, the government's argument that I can tell from the record that these defendants were sentenced under something other than the residual clause. But why shouldn't you have to wait for the Supreme Court to bless this, to 2255?
So the first answer is that this 2255 can rise and fall with the ACCA and doesn't need to reach the 3559C. That's within the scope of permissible relief to grant a full resentencing.
And then you would just but that would still leave you, if we don't reach the 3559C, your client will still have life sentences, correct?
No, because under a full resentencing on all counts, the parties would be free to address whether 3559C today should apply.
Oh, I see.
And so
your
there would be no 2255.
Your argument is that because if we undid the ACCA sentence, we should send it back for a full resentencing.
Correct.
Because the judge, I'm still not clear why the judge would have to revisit the 3559.
So this would be a reverse, if I may respond.
Yes.
This would be a reversal specifically of the denial of 2255 relief with a remand to the district court to determine the appropriate relief. And under 2243, the judge has broad discretion to grant a full resentencing or any other relief that the judge deems fair and equitable.
And if the judge did not do a broad resentencing, then what would happen? You'd be back up here arguing to 3559?
There would be different issues to appeal at that point because it would be under a different posture.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I think our briefing discusses why Blackstone is distinguishable and why the new rule in Johnson extends to 3559C.
Thank you. So the next case, the case of United States versus Harold Van Hooser is submitted. The next case is United States versus Alan Lawrence Shelby.